verses 4 through 6 in Psalm 96. We'll read it. For the Lord is great and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods. For all the gods of the people are idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Honor and majesty are before Him. Strength and beauty are in His sanctuary. Verses 1, 2, and 3, as we mentioned, are the command. It's the call to worship. He says, sing unto the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Bless His name. Proclaim the good news. Declare His glory and His wonders among all the peoples. And so you notice in verse 4, this is kind of the reason why. He's going to tell them why. And the first reason is because the Lord is great. But before we kind of jump into what these words mean, I want to just talk about generally just the object of our worship. There's a couple of things that are required in order to worship God. And we get a little glimpse of that from Hebrews chapter 11. So go ahead and keep your place there in Psalm 96. We're going to be right back there. But I want us to look at this verse, Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 6. Just a little insight on what is required of someone to worship God. It is not something that can just be done on our own, on a whim. There's a couple of things that need to be there. And Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6 says this. But without faith, it is impossible to please Him, that is God. For he who comes to God, in other words, comes to Him to worship. This is speaking of God, people coming to God in worship. Must believe that He is, that's the first thing, and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. So there's two things. All right, those who come to God in worship must first of all believe that He is, and secondly, must believe that He has revealed certain things about Himself. You say, well, where'd you get all that from? Yeah, He is a rewarder. Well, we'll get to that in a second. But the first thing is that those who come to God must obviously believe that He exists. Okay, but there's more to that. He's not simply saying here that those who come to God must have an idea of God. There's implied in that is that to accept God as He is means to acknowledge that we are who we are. To say, I understand that there is something wrong with me, there is something greater than me, there is something out there that I am recognizing is greater than I am. I am not God, there is something that is out there, okay, that must believe that He is. But obviously, just acknowledging that there is a God, that there is a higher being, that there is something greater than you, is a far cry from worship. There's a lot of people who acknowledge that, but that doesn't mean that they are saved for one, or that they can offer up true worship. That's where the second part comes in. That He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. In other words, that this God, this being, this high power, this great God, has personality. He has revealed things about Himself. So therefore, there are parameters to coming to God. We cannot come to God on our own terms. We use a lot of terminology like this, and we really need to kind of stay away from it. We use terms like this, you know, that, you know, I found the Lord. The Lord ain't lost. We're the one that's lost. He finds us, okay? But secondly, we say things like, I found religion, or I've made peace with God. You know, listen, that we understand what people mean when they say that, but what behind all of that is that I've kind of come to terms with God on my own. You know, that's not how it works. That's not how it works. We can't come to God and say, okay, God, you know, here it is. All right, I'm going to be good, and I'm going to acknowledge that You're there, and I'm going to kind of clean up my act. That's not worship. We come to God on His terms. There's only one way to come to the Father, and that's through the Son. Meaning, I acknowledge that I'm a sinner and dead broke. In my spiritual bank account, I'm in debt, and I cannot pay that debt. Christ Jesus is the only one that can pay my debt. That God has revealed certain things about Himself, and we are required. We are required to come to Him on those terms. The Old Testament is full of illustrations of this. people worshiping the right God in the wrong way. They were coming to the right God with the wrong motives. They were worshiping the right God with a bad heart, bad attitudes. You read the prophets, a lot of time God says, put your hands down. The smell of your sacrifices stink to me. He would say things like, close your mouth. I don't want to hear your song. I mean, these are some pretty strong words. So there is a wrong way to come to God. Now, let me kind of qualify all that saying, I'm not talking about a sinner who is crying out to God. They really don't know a lot about Him yet, but they just know because I'm not saying that we have to have a PhD in theology before we get saved. That's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is that when God reveals Himself to you, or when we have an inclination to come to God, we have to understand that there are certain ways to do that. In worship, He gives us a pretty clear criteria that we just don't recognize that He's there and say, well, I think God is a pretty good old boy. I know God must be a loving God. He's not going to care really, you know, how I think or act or dress or feel or sing. He's just a good guy, just a good, you know, kind of a grandpa kind of person. No, that is wrong. We should not assume or presume anything upon God. And I think this is something that God gives true believers. This is a sense of inadequacy, a sense of, you know, I can't be doing this right, you know. So if you ever have this attitude where, well, you know, it'd be all right, it'd be okay, that's a dangerous attitude to have when approaching to God. Because those who come to God must believe that He is, but also that He's a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. That those who seek Him the right way, those who seek Him with a pure heart, an honest heart, that doesn't mean a sinless heart, but a heart that says, Lord, I'm broken, I'm undone. Remember what Isaiah said in Isaiah 6? I'm a man of unclean lips. I dwell amongst a people of unclean lips. And Lord, I need Your help. I recognize who You are, and You have revealed Yourself to me. But this also implies that in order for worship to be done right, in order for a church to worship God aright, the truth has to be there. The truth must be there. So whether it be through song, whatever way we decide to worship God, if our minds are not directed by the truth, there's a danger there that we're not actually worshiping right. So if it's all emotions and it's all noise, and it's only appealing to the emotions, then there's a possibility we could be worshiping the wrong way. Because worship is tied to the truth. Because God has revealed Himself. And worship is all of us responding to all who He is. And so if we don't know who He is, we can't worship Him right. So those are the prerequisites to worship. And that's why tonight's message is about the object of our worship. It's God, who He is, His nature. Because in Psalm 96, verses 4 through 6, that's what the psalmist is turning our attention to. So let's go back there. Go to Psalm 96. Because he calls everyone to worship in verses 1, 2, and 3. And then verses 4, 5, and 6, he's telling us why. He's telling us why. And it's not because God has done anything. He is calling our attention to who He is. And this is a very, very important thing to remember. Because God is worthy of worship even if He does nothing.
Man,
even if He does nothing. Okay? By His very nature, by His very existence, calls for worship. That's hard for us to think about, because when we think of loving someone or adoring someone or honoring someone, or if we think of somebody being worthy, it's always tied to something that they do. They are a loving person, or they have done something honorable, or they have done something worthy of praise, all right? But God is not that way. He is, by His very existence, worthy of all of those things. It's just that He is. That's what Hebrews 11:6 says. And just because He is calls us to worship. This is an amazing thing. Look at verse 4. You see His reason or the motivation for worship? Because He's great. Worship God, why? Because He's great. We think we have that old children's prayer, you know, God is good, God is great, you know, that old where we pray for the meal or whatever. That's something very simplistic. It's so simple, but it really is pretty profound. It's in the Bible. Why should we worship God? Well, He's great. Well, that seems kind of simple, but it's huge. What kind of a great? Well, there's a couple kind of greatnesses, I guess you'd say. There's a moral greatness. He does great things. But he's not talking about anything that he's done. He's just great. He is great in his own essence, in his own being. His very being is great. He didn't have to do anything. He is great, and he is greatly to be praised. It's kind of a play on words here in Hebrews, just saying that just because of who he is, he is worthy to be praised simply because of who he is. So God is great. But look what he says next. Because he is great, he is greatly to be praised. And he says in verse 4, he is also to be feared. He is to be feared above all gods. And this is probably one of the most significant deficiencies in a lot of worship. Is this fear aspect. And a lot of it's because we're confused. There's a misunderstanding of what that means. And it's almost like one of those things like having a baby. Until you've done it, you really don't know what it's like. But until you experience the fear of God, you really can't explain it too much. It's one of those things where it just kind of happens. When you are confronted with the presence of God and the being of God, when He's revealed to you, when you read something in the Bible, or when God reveals Himself to you in some way, whether it could be through the Bible, it could be through nature, it could be through some experience, but when you come to the realization that God is great, that His greatness and His muchness, His superiority to everything, when you're confronted with that, there's this sense, this overwhelming sense where of I'm down here and God is so far up there, and there's this great divide. But it's kind of ironic if you think of it. It's kind of a paradox. We feel so far away from God when we're in His presence. You see how that is? Like the closer we get to God, the farther we feel from Him. Isn't it kind of weird? When we are so near to Him, we are so much smaller and He's so much greater. That we just want to say, whoa. I mean, think about all of the examples in the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament. When God revealed Himself to somebody in a bodily form or some sort of burning bush or something like that, almost every single time, you know where the person's face was when they saw God? On the ground. Just think about all the times Jesus revealed Himself to His apostles or any of the disciples. You know the first thing He said to them? Fear not. Fear not. Why would He say that if they weren't afraid? There is this sense when you're confronted with the greatness of God. And I'm not talking about scared, but there is kind of this element of there's a shock factor there where you're in awe and wonder, but they're on the ground. They're on the ground. And the root of the word worship means to be down. It's to be on the ground. That's part of what is inherent in the idea of worship is down. It's just because that's what it's about. I mean, I'm not saying that we have to worship on our faces all the time, but if we are worshiping rightly, our hearts, our minds are bowed down. That's what it's supposed to be. A lot of times, though, when churches are attempting to create an atmosphere of worship, we try to do the opposite. We try to build people up and get them excited to be there, to get them excited to be in church, to get them excited about whether the music or something like that. And there's not, it's not all wrong, but the problem is that we could kind of get people so worked up that we forget what we're doing. There's a big difference between enjoying a good song and being moved by a good song, and then worship. Okay, there's nothing wrong with being moved by a good song. I mean, it could be any kind of old song. I mean, it could be a Christian song, it could be a secular song, but music moves people. I mean, God has created music for that purpose, but it's why. I mean, what is actually moving you? The being of God? Are you confronted with the greatness of God, or is it just a good song? See, there's a big difference there. What is beautiful and what is difficult sometimes is balancing the two. Having a beautiful song that exalts God. Now, when you have those two things, that's a marvelous recipe for worship. But if you're not aware of that, if we're not aware of that, we're going to desire just to be moved. I don't care how it moves me. I just want a song that moves me. But that's not worship. So it is the church's responsibility to focus the attention of the people on the object of worship, which is God. Now, how do we do that? When we need, the truth needs to be there. You know, we do it in song, we do it in preaching, but however we get there, we need to make sure that the being of God is first and foremost. The psalmist here is saying, because God is great, He's greatly to be praised, and He's to be feared. He says in the end of verse 4, He is to be feared above all gods. In the verse 5, this is the reason why. For all the gods of the peoples are idols. Now, verse 4 might lead you to think, and some theologians debate over this, whether there really are gods. Because it seems in verse 4 that the psalmist here is acknowledging the fact that there are other gods, but they're inferior to the one true God. That cannot be so. There is only one true God, because he says in verse 5, for all the gods of the peoples are idols. Idols. Okay? The word idol, you know what the word idol means? Nothing. That's literally what it means. Nothing. In Hebrew, they would be hearing, for all the gods are nothing. They're not a thing. They don't exist. They're absolutely nothing. So these gods with the little g that he's talking about are the so-called gods. The fake gods. They're not real gods. So what he's saying here is that whatever is contrived in the minds of people, whatever we can conceive of, whether it be a fake god or a fake religion or whatever man-made thing we put before God, those things are nothing. They are not real gods. So God is to be feared above everything else. Every other false religion, every other false god, every other man-made idol that we can think of is inferior to the one true God. Implied in all this, though, is that mankind is created to worship. Religion is one of the few things that has always been, from the beginning of time. I mean, all of the ancient literature that man has, that we have at our disposal, when we go back, religion is a fundamental part of every community, every civilization. It's always there. We are created to turn our hearts towards something else. The problem is, as Romans chapter 1 talks about, is that man usually goes to the things that are created. That our hearts are inclined to worship things that we create. In Isaiah chapter 44, you know what? We've got the time. Let's look at it. Go to Isaiah chapter 44, which a lot of people say Psalm 96 is drawing a lot of things on Isaiah. And it's pretty clear, especially in this verse. Isaiah chapter 44, and let's start at verse 9. Pretty amazing and very, very strong language that Isaiah or the Lord is giving His people. Is everybody there? Isaiah chapter 44. We're going to pick up in verse 9. It's stout words. All right, verse 9. Those who make an image, all of them are useless, empty, void, and their precious things shall not profit. They are their own witnesses. They neither see nor know, that they may be ashamed. Who would form a god or mold an image that profits him nothing? Verse 11. Surely all his companions would be ashamed, and the workmen, they are mere men. Let them all be gathered together. Let them stand up, yet they shall fear. They shall all be ashamed together. He's calling everyone to kind of think about what you're doing. This is nonsense, really. To worship an idol, he's saying, is just stupid. Think about what you're doing. Now he's about to elaborate how dumb it is. The blacksmith with the tongs works one in the coals, fashions it with hammers, and works it with the strength of his arms. Even so he is hungry, and his strength fails. He drinks no water and is faint. The craftsman stretches out his rule. He marks one out with chalk. He fashions it with a plane. He marks it out with a compass. It makes it like the figure of man, according to the beauty of a man, that it may remain in his house. He cuts down cedars for himself. He takes the cypress and the oak. He secures it for himself among the trees of the forest. He plants a pine, and the rain nourishes it. Then it shall be for a man to burn, for he will take some of it and warm himself. Yes, he kindles it and bakes bread. Indeed, he makes a god and worships it, He makes it a carved image and falls down to it. He burns half of it in the fire. With this half, he eats meat. He roasts a roast and is satisfied. And he even warms himself and says, "Oh, I am warm. I have seen the fire." And the rest, he makes it into a god. His carved image. He falls down before it and worships it. Prays to it and says, "Deliver me, for you are my God." You see what he's saying? He's saying, think about reasonably and logically what you're doing. You are making this thing with your own sweat and toil. You planted the tree in which to make this thing. And then you take that tree, you use half of it to supply your family, feed yourself, and warm yourself. Then the other half you make a god, and then you stand before the very same thing that you use to feed yourself. You're calling it your god. How dumb is that? But think about it. Do we do that? Can we in modern day man, do we not do the same thing? Do we not go to work for the old mighty dollar and we toil and we spend our own sweat and we make our money? And if we depend, put all of our hope and all of our chips and our money and our jobs and our stuff, and we do everything we can to preserve those things and our way of life and to make sure we have everything that we need, because if we don't, what are we going to do? What are we going to do if I don't have money? And we make money our god, or we make some sort of entertainment our god, or we make whatever. The principle applies. The same principle applies. It's created. It's man-made. We create money. You know, money is not a natural mineral. You know that there's no such thing as a money tree, you know, or a money plant. You can't go dig up dollar bills. It's paper. It's paper that we make. But how much power that paper has. Oh my goodness. You know, they have those those game shows or whatever where they'll put a person in this box, a sealed glass box, you know, and drop money down, and they'll try to grab all of it, or you drop money in a crowd of people and it's like just chaos. But think about that. It's paper. You drop paper, green paper with numbers on it, in a crowd of people. I mean, think about it. You do it at a football game or something like that. You will cause fights. People will probably get killed, trampled. They will trample over old women, pregnant women. Doesn't matter, because of that piece of paper. That's the idea. Think about what you're doing. It's a piece of paper. That's the same thing here. It's a piece of wood. What are you doing? Worshipping a piece of wood. What are we doing worshipping a piece of paper? The same idea applies. Look at verse 18. "For they do not know nor understand. For he has shut their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so that they cannot understand. And no one considers in his heart, nor is there knowledge or understanding to say, I have burned half of it in the fire. Yes, I have also baked bread on its coals. I have roasted meat and eaten, and shall make the rest into an abomination. Shall I fall down before a block of wood? He feeds on ashes. A deceived heart has turned him aside, as he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand?" Isaiah is just saying, the spiritual darkness and the blindness that is inherent in idolatry is so powerful that people will worship stuff. This has always been the case, because we are fallen and sinful. Now go back to Psalm 96. This is what he's contrasting. That God is to be feared above everything else. Anything and everything else. Everyone else. But why? Look what he says. Look at verse 5. "For all the gods of the people are idols." There's nothing there. They're not a thing. "But the Lord made the heavens." You see that? Because God, as creator, is the creator. So think about why would you worship any created thing when there's a creator? That Romans chapter 1, that's the very same thing that he says there, that we worship the creature rather than the creator. That is at the heart of idolatry, that we are more prone to worship things that we've created, things that we make with our own hands, instead of the one who created it. And Isaiah says that's really the most ignorant thing you could ever do. That is really, if you think about it, it is really so dumb. But it happens all the time. And even God's people, sometimes we can be led astray by doing the same things. And God has to whoop us back in shape and say, "Listen, your heart is too focused on your stuff. I've given you that stuff. I've given you that house. I've given you that car. I've given you all of those things. But don't look to those things. Look to me." And when we worship, we have to keep the object of our worship in focus. Because the ironic thing is that we can make worship into an idol. It's something that we can get so caught up on a form or a style or, you know, sort of particular type of music that I can't worship with anything else except that music leader and that kind of music or that CD or, you know, if I'm in this place or with that piano or with that organ or with that music or, you know, we kind of think that if I don't have these particular things in order, I'm not going to be able to worship. I can't worship with that person or that song or that kind of music. That just that attitude is saying, I've made worship, my kind of worship, my idol. So if it doesn't move me or appeal to me, I can't worship God. But the fact is, worship is a response to who God is.
Amen.
It's not a particular kind of music. It's not a particular kind of atmosphere. That's why I want us to look at verse 6, because it's what I call the result of worship. Okay? But look what he says. Honor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. What is he saying? This is a form of Hebrew poetry where they say the same thing in two different ways. Okay, so the first stanza, I guess you'd say, the first phrase is honor and majesty are before him. You could even translate or in his presence, before him, right there. That's who God is. Honor and majesty are in his presence. And the second phrase is really saying the same thing. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. So for Old Testament saints, to say strength and beauty are in their sanctuary is equivalent of saying strength and beauty are in His presence. Because that's where God's presence was manifested, in the sanctuary. So there are these things here, and you know, many other adjectives could be added to these, but these four are pretty major. That honor, majesty, strength, and beauty are in God's presence. And to worship is to be in God's presence. To worship is to respond to the being and presence of God. When we are confronted with God, there are certain things that result in that. He's already mentioned fear to be one. Godly fear, we reverence who He is. But here are four more. So these are kind of guidelines, kind of little parameters that we can say that these things should be the natural result of true worship. So if these things are not happening, if these things are not cultivated in our hearts and minds, it's a good indicator we really might not be worshiping. We might just be listening to some good music. We just might be moved by simply our emotions. But the psalmist here is saying, listen, when people are in your presence, there's some things that should be coming to your mind. First of all, he says honor. This word honor has the idea of splendor or greatness, or you could even say glory. Some of you translated glory, that there's a sense of amazing, just awe, just wonder. It's the sense you can get if you watch this thing. When you've witnessed something, has anybody ever been on a cruise or been on a large body of water when you just look out at this immense ocean and you feel about this big when you're looking at it? And it's just like, wow, this is huge. And it's kind of this overwhelming sense of, if I fall into this thing, I'm done. Because they'll never find me. I'll probably get eaten by something first. But you know, I'm such a small thing in this huge thing. There's so much glory and wonder and awe in this bigness. That's the idea behind this word. That when we are confronted with God, when we're approaching God, we feel a sense like this. And I can't imagine that I have the ability or the honor or the privilege to come before this big God, this great God. The sense of honor should be there. And the same idea with the word majesty. But with this word majesty, it has the idea of not so much big, but just glorious. Just glory. It's beautiful. It's intricate. It's a detail. That it's not so much like you look at a large ocean, but it's you see every single wave and every single detail. I've got this wonderful picture. Diane and I went on a cruise for her birthday several years ago, and I was standing on the deck looking at the sunset. And the waves of the ocean, it was real calm, but there was just enough movement of the water. It wasn't like glass, but there was just enough movement in the water where it made tiny ripples. And so the sun was setting behind some clouds, and the clouds made these horizontal lines all the way up, as high as you could see. So there were these red stripes going on the clouds like this, and it was reflecting off of the water that had waves that were making horizontal lines as well. And I took this picture because you could not tell where the sky stopped and the water started. You just couldn't tell. It just looked like one sheet of red stripes. It was amazing. But I was just looking at all the detail and how perfectly God placed everything right there. That's majesty. I felt small because of the bigness of what I was seeing, but I was also amazed at how just intricate everything was. That's a result of being in the presence of God. That your mind is not focused simply on how big and glorious and great He is, but all the little details, that He cares, that He's a loving God, that He cares about you in this vast universe of people and things. He's a personal God that knows you by name. That is a result of worship. That we're not a number. We don't have a barcode stamped on the back of our head. But God knows every single one of us by name. Scripture says He's created us in the womb, and He knows us even before we were even born. Glory and majesty are before Him. And then there's strength. There's strength. When worship is offered rightly, one leaves with a greater sense of the reality of God's strength and power. That's one of the wonderful things about worship. That we are giving God, we are acknowledging God, we are worshiping Him, but there is a sense that when we leave from that worship, we're saying, man, God is so strong. But what does it do for us? When we recognize God's strength, then we think of scriptures like, if God is for us, say it with me, who can be against us? What? If we acknowledge God's strength and we're confronted with the strength of God, when we go to work on Monday and we're weak, we're going to be remembering, hey, I remember yesterday, God is too strong. God is so strong that I don't need to worry about my weakness right now. That's why worship is so important, that we focus our attention on God's honor, God's majesty, and God's strength. Because if we focus on anything else, Monday morning is going to be hard. The week's going to be hard. Struggles are going to be hard. When we face difficulties, we're going to be depending on our own self. We're going to be depending on our own strength, our own abilities. When we are worshiping God rightly, we're going to get a greater sense of the strength and power of God in our lives. And then finally, it's beauty. Strength and beauty are in His sanctuary. They're in His presence. When we're confronted with God, there is beauty there. I was in a class, I think it was last semester. It was a philosophy class. So, you know, we always talk about stupid stuff in philosophy class. No, philosophy's got a place. But anyway, what my teacher asked, he asked this question. It was a pretty fascinating question. He says, is beauty an objective reality or a subjective reality? In other words, is beauty in the eye of the beholder, or are there certain criteria for beauty? Yeah, half the class said, well, beauty's kind of whatever you think's beauty, because some people think some things are beautiful and some people think other things are beautiful. And he challenged us to think about that. And he started asking us questions like, well, do you think a picture of a sunset is beautiful? And everybody said, yeah, this sunset's beautiful. Well, what do you think? He showed us a picture. He said, well, what do you think of this painting? Is that beautiful? And some people said, yeah, kind of beautiful. Half said, no, it's kind of plain, kind of simple. He said, well, what about this? He didn't show us a picture of this. He said, what about an obscene image? What if it was a person that was nude? Would you think that was beautiful? All the Christian, students, all the Bible students said, no, that crosses the line, right? And don't you know, forever, from the beginning of time, there have been paintings and sculptures of nudity. But from the beginning of God's people, God has said, listen, that's not beautiful. So if there are parameters to beauty, then that means beauty is not subjective. It is objective. So what has to guide what is beautiful? And the conclusion was, what has to be the truth? Well, who determines what is true? Because there are a lot of people who would look at a person in the nude and say, well, that's just beautiful. But can Christian people look at somebody nude and say, that's beautiful? We say, no, that's obscene. Why? Because God says it is. To look upon somebody else's nakedness is sin. That's pornography. It's not beauty. So the truth must guide what is true and what is beautiful. So strength and beauty are in a sanctuary. The same thing as saying that, listen, if we want to see what is beautiful, if we want to know what is beautiful, then the truth is indispensable. This is why we are going through the Bible to try to determine what is worship. This is why we're using the Scripture to guide us on how to worship and what the nature of worship is, who the object of our worship, because worship is a beautiful thing, but worship, just like beauty, is not a subjective experience. You can worship the wrong way. You can worship the right God in the wrong way. This is why I'm praying that God would take these messages from Psalm 96, and this is not an exhaustive, you know, detailed description of everything about worship, but I'm hoping this is guidelines that when we worship, when we come here on Sundays or Wednesdays or whenever we gather together as Christian people, you know, that's our primary purpose of meeting on Sunday morning is to worship. We worship, we give thanks, we give gifts to each other, offerings. That's basically what it is. We study the Bible together. So when we come to church on Sundays or whatever day, that we would have these things in our mind. And so as we sing and we offer up worship and we are worshiping, that we would think about these things and say, hey, is my mind worshiping God because of who He is? Or am I just simply worshiping God for what He's done? And by the way, there's nothing wrong with worshiping God for what He's done. I'm just saying that that's not required in worship. We can worship God simply for who He is. But, I mean, for us, we worship God for what He's done for us. Amazing things. Salvation and grace and providing for us. These are all worshipful things. So let me kind of review. There are two prerequisites, at least, from worshiping God. And we kind of glean these from Hebrews 11:6. And that is that we must recognize that God is, okay? He is the one and only true God, but we also must worship Him as He has revealed Himself. We must worship God because He is great, because He is to be feared, and because He's Creator. And that idolatry can creep in if we are not on our guard for that, because our sinful fallen nature is naturally inclined to worship the creature instead of the Creator. And then when we worship, we can kind of have some guidelines, and this is not an exhaustive list, but guidelines to kind of measure ourselves, I guess you could say, to see whether we're worshiping God right. Do we have a greater sense of the honor and glory of God? Are we amazed more of the majesty of God? Do we have a greater sense of the strength of God? And do we understand the beauty of God more? Now, there other things could be added to that, but we must ask ourselves, am I worshiping God or am I just singing?
Right.
Am I just singing? Am I just getting emotional? Or do I leave Sunday mornings or Wednesday or whether you're driving in your car? I mean, there's not a particular location where you have to worship, but when you get this sense of I'm worshiping God, do you leave with this? Mm-hmm. Have you been affected by it? There's a lot of terminology that a lot of churches use to try to highlight the worship portion of the service. And some of it's misleading. One of those terms are come experience God. Okay, and I understand what they're trying to say, but what they're doing is they're really kind of highlighting a particular portion of the worship service. And it's really all about just simply music. And some of the music's not really grounded in the truth or theology. So, but there is an experience. Worshiping God is an experience, but when you're inviting people to say, hey, you want an experience? Come experience this. That's not worship. We go offer worship, and the experience is that we just confronted the one true God. We have just seen God. That's the experience. But we don't go to church for the experience. That just happens. God has to create that. You cannot create an experience of worship by yourself. You just can't do it. You can manufacture some superficial worship kind of things, but it's not worship. So I just want us to think about worship as being confronted with God. He is the object of our worship. And I pray that God helps us to understand that.